history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there, eye-opening stories, sobering stories, inspiring stories just waiting to be told if we'll only ask a few questions and take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we truly are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. You know, I realize that those of you who listen on a regular basis always see the relevance in the stories we hear. Sometimes there might be some nostalgia about the way things once were. Other times, you tell me that hearing one veteran share his story helps you understand what it might have been like for your dad, your grandpa, your uncle, who never talked about his service in World War II. But I don't know if there's ever been a time in the 15 years that I've spent interviewing veterans that these stories from the past have been more relevant to what's happening today. The coronavirus pandemic has interrupted life in our country and in the world to a degree that we in America haven't experienced since World War II. So maybe there are some things we can glean from the past to bring to bear in the present. With that said, I invite you to access any of the more than 600 episodes archived for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And for today's episode, it's an opportunity to mark another 75th anniversary. It's an anniversary that will be observed at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. this week, just minus the crowd that usually accompanies such an event. On Tuesday, March 24th, you can stream online the commemoration live on the Facebook Live feed of the Friends of the National World War II Memorial. I have a link for you at hometownheroesradio.com. They'll be marking the 75th anniversary of an effort that remains the largest airborne operation ever carried out on a single day in one location. That would be Operation Varsity, and it's often overshadowed by previous airborne engagements in Europe and World War II. We've heard a lot on this show over the years from the paratroopers who jumped behind enemy lines on D-Day. We've heard about Operation Dragoon and the invasion of southern France, about Operation Market Garden in the Netherlands, and of course we've heard from airborne troops who survived the Battle of the Bulge. But it's not too often we hear about Operation Varsity, which had nearly 17,000 paratroopers and glider infantry troops descending on the area around Wesel, Germany, and the Rhine River. The strategy for Operation Varsity tried to incorporate lessons learned from some of those previous drops. 540 airplanes carried 12 parachute battalions, six of them American, five British, and one Canadian, and right behind them came 1,300 gliders, all loaded up with troops. Nearly 3,000 of those 17,000 soldiers would end up killed, wounded, or captured. 56 aircraft were lost, and 16 more would be shot down while resupplying those troops. The result of all of it was an acceleration of Germany's defeat, with Operation Varsity forces capturing more than 3,500 German prisoners, and more importantly, securing bridges on the Rhine and towns in the vicinity that could have given German forces the leverage to slow that Allied advance. Today we're going to hear the memories of three men who were a part of Operation Varsity, two glider pilots, and one paratrooper. In the paratrooper's case, this would be his first taste of combat. For the glider pilots, they'd been through a few things prior. They had survived one-way glider flights in those previous airborne assaults in Europe. For glider pilot Morris Bennett, Operation Varsity meant dropping in just 50 miles further down the river from where he'd almost been killed 6 months prior in the Market Garden operation. Let's pick up his memories there so we can add a little perspective to how accustomed he was to these life-and-death situations by the time Operation Varsity launched in March 1945.
Arnhem, Nijmegen, we grossed back, and we had the 82nd Airborne, is what we took in, and we didn't have enough pilots, so we didn't even have a co-pilot. And part of the equipment I had, there was a trailer with all the signal equipment, all the electronics for the communications for the whole group. So I had the trailer with that and the two people that worked with it. Some of them were shot down on the way in, but we knew it was going to be a rough mission. It was about 3 hours on tow, and we left somewhere around 7 in the morning. It was in September. We had Mae West, but I put an extra flak suit under my seat and went over my legs and one over my deal. And right after we hit the coast of the Rhodes, we were shot at by ground fire, barges on the bottom, and then we were shot at also by fighters. But the Spitfires came in and the P-51s came in, our defense boys, and they took those out and they took out the other deal. But I could see the tracers coming down. You see them going through the side of the tow ship and come out on down the tow line. And then by that time, they were going through ours. And that was probably the scariest mission that I had as far as wondering if I was even going to get on the ground. But after we got over the barges and got a little further inland, we were able to land. But I was picking up ground fire after I hit the CP. And we landed about 10:30 in the morning. The paratroopers were dropping at the same time we dropped. Normally, paratroopers come in ahead of us and clear the ground before we get in. But we were on the ground at the same time that they were. First lieutenant ran over to me and he says, I kind of cracked up a little bit. I mean, I had to get on the ground because I was being shot at pretty heavy.
And that glider, with what it's made out of, doesn't take fire very well.
And so I landed a little bit faster than I normally would land, and it was sandy. And I nosed over, so I just knocked the nose end of it off a little bit, but the load and everything else was on the ground in good shape. I landed right by an ammunition dump. There were all kinds of ammunition and guns and everything. There were stacks of them that the Germans had got together. And I says, I think I'm okay. In other words, of course, I was kind of dusty and dirty. Of course, you got probably 30 pounds of equipment, your helmet and all the other gear and the ammunition, and your legs are full of groceries for 3 or 4 days or whatever the case would be. You have everything on you that you don't have no chance of picking nothing up. You're all ready to go. So when you landed, you got out of there. We went over to this castle, and the German officers had just left it having breakfast. Everything was still ham and eggs and everything just on the table when we landed. And so we stayed there that afternoon, and then that night they marched us downtown, and we took the bridge that crossed the Rhine, the 82nd Airborne. Mortar fire was hitting us pretty heavy, so they come over and said, in other words, well, you glider pilots, you are guards, you're going to be MPs. So I was an MP for 3 weeks with about 10 glider pilots, and we had over 3,000 prisoners. And we took an apple orchard that had a high deer fence around it. They couldn't come in and reinforce us or bring in any more troopers, and they tried to by air, but the weather was bad. And they made some paradrops. So after paradropped it, they dropped in the German lines, and the Germans got them. And this was at Nijmegen, or the Arnhem, which is a bridge too far. There's a movie on the bridge too far. Well, this is where it was. And so about 3 weeks, we were relieved. They finally got through to us. The British came in and with the tanks and relieved us, and we went back. And I don't even remember how we ate. We didn't eat very much. In other words, I know that, because all we had was K-rations with Cracker Jack boxes. But anyway, we got back on this Army 6x6. And then while I was sitting there, like we was sitting on benches on that thing, and one of the guys that was with us, in other words, he didn't unload his gun or did something, and it went off in the truck bed. But in other words, none of us was hurt. So
it's just in a growing list of close calls. That was part of Operation Market Garden, and before long, the Battle of the Bulge would come along.
The next one was resupply on Bastogne. But what happened on that, I was ready to go. I was to take, it was on December 25th, and I was supposed to take off. The weather turned bad, and I really loaded, and all I had was ammunition to resupply. And went out the next morning. I didn't have to fly it because they brought in somebody else, because they said I already had flown enough missions.
So you were going to fly a glider into Bastogne in the middle of the Battle of the Bulge.
Right. And I was set to go on that, but in other words, then I didn't fly it. So somebody else flew my glider, but it was wrecked, and the guy that flew it was killed. It was on the pilots that took it in the next day. I think the old boy up above is watching over me, and he had something more for me to do. That's the only thing that I've had, because I had too many of them that it just wasn't done till it could have been 5 minutes or 10 minutes or an hour later. So then the next mission we had was crossing the Rhine at Wesel, which was only 50 miles by on the river from where we dropped in September, or the original on the Grossbeck drop. But I had, I think, just troopers, and I flew a CG-4, and we flew a two gliders on the same tow ship. We came in across the Rhine River Valley, and broke out of the smoke about 200 feet, and all I had was an apple orchard ahead of us. just landed down between the apple orchard and took the wings off, the outside wings, came in pretty high and slipped and straightened out just before it got where I was supposed to land. And of course, it took some real good flying there to do it. Flying by your seat of pants again, landed, and we were right up against an 88. By this time, that the German army couldn't hit the airplanes at a low altitude. They had to be up pretty high before they could hit them. They didn't know how to set their guns to shoot at 500 feet. But they got where they were, there the tail end, and we landed within maybe 50 feet of a German 88 gun emplacement. And my crew, my ground people, was able to take them over right then.
So the troopers you were carrying took out that 88. Otherwise, you would have been blown to smithereens.
Well, that's right. In other words, that was it. And then the next morning, we stayed that night, whole night in foxholes, and we took parachutes that had been dropped and wrapped them around for to keep warm. And next morning, we went back, and that was the end of my fighting.
So that's one glider pilot's take on Operation Varsity. Wasn't it amazing how matter-of-fact he was? I'm sure it had something to do with what he had done on D-Day and in Market Garden. That was Morris Bennett, and we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, another glider pilot's memories of Operation Varsity and why he had to land his glider one-handed. Operation Varsity was unfolding 75 years ago this week, and you'll hear more firsthand accounts when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, a program that I hope during these uncertain times will help you remember that our country has faced uncertain times before. And when we face our challenges together with faith and hope and unity, we can and we will overcome. That's what 16 million Americans in uniform and countless more standing behind them back home accomplished in the 1940s. And today's special episode marks the 75th anniversary of Operation Varsity, the largest airborne assault of all time when it comes to a single day and a single place. On Tuesday, March 24th at 11:30 a.m. Eastern or 8:30 Pacific, you can watch a live stream of the official commemoration, sans the crowd, from the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. You'll hear the big picture and a few examples of the heroism that made that effort a success. But here on Hometown Heroes, we get to explore the memories of some of those involved. We'll hear from a paratrooper who jumped that day in a bit, but for now, another glider pilot. Mel Pliner had just recovered from Operation Market Garden in the Netherlands when he and other glider pilots were moved into position for what would be a 1,300 glider assault on the Rhine.
It was shortly after that that the 4th 30th Troop Carrier Group transferred over to France to an air base A-55 just outside of Fontainebleau, famous church there.
Right.
And more training. There was a wrecked B-26 on the base off the side. When I was assigned my Waco glider, I took some tools and went over there, and I got out a couple of pieces of armor plate.
From the B-26?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I put one under my seat and one under my feet. in the glider that I was assigned. This time, I had 13 troops, and I was assigned a co-pilot that was a washed-out cadet. He didn't make it in power pilot, so he transferred to the glider program. Mm-hmm. He had about 2 hours flight time. Never been in combat.
Uh-huh.
Came time to take off, and we're waiting in line, and one of the troops fired a rifle. They're holding a rifle like that.
Yeah.
And he pulled the trigger, fired around. I got out of my seat to check to see if he'd have cut any of my control wires, my control cables. Fortunately, he didn't. I said, "You guys, put your rifles on safe, all of you," which they did. Okay. Came time we took off. This time, we're going for the Rhine invasion. Get into formation of echelon four to right. Okay, we get ready to approach the Rhine River. Drop down to 500. As we cross the river, I couldn't see the Weitzel. But before we took off, I was assigned a bazooka. And my co-pilot had a vest, 3 rockets in front, 3 rockets behind for the bazooka.
Right.
We were going to land close to a main intersection highway where we were supposed to join other troops to set up a defense to keep any resupplies from getting to the troops
right
in the front line.
Cutting their supply line.
Cross the Rhine, drop down, green light, red light, and I cut loose. And here's a big field, I don't know how many acres, big power lines with the high towers across the field and gliders. Some of them hit the wires. So I figured, well, okay, I cut loose, and I'm heading for that. And I got a place where there's room for me to land my glider. I'm 200 feet high, and I'm holding the wheel like this. And some krauts, a bird shooter. Now, you know, most of the krauts were aiming at the pilot's compartment, and it was going to the tail section. This guy's a bird shooter. You know how you lead birds?
Yeah.
He was the bird shooter. I'm sitting like that, and he gets me right through the arm between the radius and the other.
Still have a scar
see
there?
See that?
Uh-huh.
That's where it came out.
Oh.
I said, "Take over, I'm hit."
So this is your co-pilot who's never done this before.
He froze.
Can't function.
I pull up the spoiler and held it up with my left foot, and I landed it with my left hand and my right foot.
Because your right hand, you can't do anything
my
with.
My right hand fell down.
It's useless.
Into shock.
So you're landing this glider one-handed.
One hand and one foot. Of course, I was only about 200 feet high. When I did that, evidently, I took and wiped out the gear on my right side, just came right off. Because over there, the fields, about every 15 furrows, was a deep one to carry any moisture off the field instead of washing the grass off over to a ravine, a little ravine over there. Came to stop with the left wheel in the ravine and my right wing about a foot or two above the ground. By that time, all the troops had gotten out, and my co-pilot came to life, and he got out. I had on a flak vest. Now, a flak vest, it's got 2 snaps on each shoulder.
Right.
And it's got a belt around the waist with snaps. Supposed to be able to give it one good jerk, and it's supposed to fall off.
Right.
Well, with my arm in shock, I'm pulling with my left hand, and it didn't come off. And I got scared, because with that thing on, you don't move very well.
It's heavy.
I gave it a second pull, and it came off. And I got out and got underneath. Spurt.
This wound in your arm is spraying blood everywhere.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I get out my first aid kit.
Because you're all alone. Everybody else is left.
Got out, put a bandage. I put it around here to stop the bleeding.
Uh-huh. You had to give yourself first aid.
Yeah. About 30, 40 minutes, my co-pilot is lying on there. And this guy, he wants to get up and run. I says, "Hell, you wouldn't run 15, 20 feet and they'd shoot you." Because there was still a lot of rifle fire. But it wasn't too long after our troops started to take over, and the rifle fire started to just about quiet down. Shortly after that, a squad of American troops was crossing the field. I said, "Now's the time to get up and get in the middle of it." And we started yelling and screaming, and about 13 troops turned around with their rifles. "American troops, hey, guy!" Showed them the American flag on our shoulder. And we got in the middle of them. We got down to the ravine there, and there were other glider pilots there, troops. And there was a first aid guy.
Mm-hmm.
He saw I had this. He's, "What happened to you?" I said, "I got one through the arm." He said, "Let me take a look." took a look at it, put some sulfur, whatever it was, wrapped it, gave me a sling. He said, how does it feel? I said, hurts like hell. He says, here's a morphine syringe. Stick it in your arm. And he says, it'll keep you from hurting, slow you down. I says, I don't want it. If I got to move out, I want to be able to move out, which we did. I started to head back towards the Rhine River. And in so doing, I'm walking up the ravine, and I come across a house. And right in front of the house is a German doctor with two troops standing there watching them. And he's got a steamer trunk with all kinds of medications and operating tools. Could have performed major surgery there. And he's working on a paratrooper. The paratrooper's got his foot up on the back of a chair with his middle toe missing. Now, whether he shot it off or what, probably.
To get himself out of the line of fire?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doctor's sewing it up, and he's got a cigar in his mouth and a .45 on his foot. He says, Doc, he says, if you hurt me, I'm going to blow your brains out. Doctor doesn't understand a word of English.
Yeah,
sewed him up, gave him a couple of pairs of crutches, and off he went. Called me over, looked, took that off. He went over there, and he got a big stick with something on it, stuck it in there. And I thought he was going to just, I was just dying. Just wrap it, which he did. Made my way over to the shores of the Rhine River where there was a first aid station and there was a nurse in there. What happened to you, Lieutenant? I said, I got one in the arm. Took it off, look at it, more powder. By then the bleeding was starting to slow down. It was bleeding a little bit, but it was a spurt, spurt, spurt. And what had happened, it went through the radiation ulna and it didn't break any bones, but it hit the nerve to the thumb. You see the difference in the size?
Ah, okay.
Hit the nerve to the thumb.
Uh-huh.
She looked at it like that. By that time, it was starting to get dark. She said, take a towel there and get out there and find a place to lie down, get some sleep, and tomorrow we'll get you out of here across the river. So I take a blanket. By now, it's dark. A couple of guys out there. Excuse me. So I lay the blanket down. It's dark, and I lie down in that thing. And I bring it over me. And it feels like there's a 2x4 right underneath my back. By that time, she had given me a shot, and I fell asleep. I got up the next morning to see what the hell was under my back. Well, you know how mud slides up between dual wheels on a truck and dries up? Hell, I could have ooched for 40 miles and never got away from it. But anyway, I got up, gave it a towel back. By that time, they had some ducks. You know what a duck is?
Yeah.
Come across back and forth. So I got in the front seat of the duck, and they had some stretcher guys they put in the duck. And across the river we went to a real first aid station where they had some doctors, but they didn't have any x-ray machines. So when the doctor looked at mine, he figured, well, it must have hit one of the bones.
He figured to get hit there with their bones so tightly worked there, it had to break something.
So he put it in a cast.
Uh-huh.
So here I am in a cast. Well, by that time, there was a little airstrip there. They were flying troops out of there. And he said, what hospital do you want to go to, in Paris or London? I says, London. So I was flown, and when I got to the hospital, they put me in a ward for bone fractures, stuff like that. And I was in a ward all by myself. I was there for 30 days, during which time the war in Europe was over. I figured I'll stay in London. And I had some English money, and after my money ran out and I couldn't withdraw any more money, I had to get on an airplane and fly over to Paris, where I called the base. They sent the Jeep out. The Jeep took me back to the air base where we were stationed, A-55. Place was deserted. Everybody was gone. Well, wasn't too long after that. Troops started to come back when their money ran out. And we were told to get ready, that we were going to be transported by train to Brussels, where we were going to get a ship to take us back to the States. And when we got there, I was assigned some ship. I don't remember the name of it, but it was a cargo ship, one of the ships that they had built to bring goods over to England, you know. In the holds, the forward hold and the aft hold, they had built racks with beds in them, cots. And I don't know how many he could put in the forward and aft, but when we got on board the ship, I was assigned one of the holds with these cots in it. And so I climbed down the ladder, got into that thing where my B4 bag and a duffel bag that I had some stuff in. And after we left port, I got back up and I went up to the cruise compartment and I talked to the steward. And I said, "Did you know my father, David Pliner, Sunrise Steamship Laundry?" He says, "Yeah, I knew him." "Well, I'm his son. I'm one of the troops down in the hold." He says, "Bring your gear up here and we'll put you in one of the cruise quarters." And I went into one of the cruise quarters, and I don't know how long the trip across the ocean was, but I went to the slop chest, got a pair of jeans and a shirt, and I was one of the crew for the duration of the trip. Had a nice place to eat. Ate with the crew 3 meals a day. We were about a couple of hours out of New York City when we were coming into the harbor. And I figured, well, I better get back down there. So I changed back into my uniform. I got back there and said, "Where the hell have you been?" I said, "None of your business." You know, I never felt myself as a hero. I felt I was trained to do a job, and that's what I did. I look at it this way. The reason that I survived is two things, my training and the man upstairs. I felt confident that, you know, once we took off, I could find a field I could land, which I did.
Even with one hand. That was glider pilot Mel Pliner, who decades after his service in World War II got to visit the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., thanks to Honor Flight Southern Nevada. Unlike his glider journeys in the war, this wasn't a one-way mission. This aircraft had power, and he wasn't the one who had to land it. That mission triggered his adrenaline in a different way.
That was an interesting trip of a lifetime. It was. I can't say how much I enjoyed that, or the people, well, the woman that was in charge, and the people that we traveled with. And when we came back from the honor flight, there were, I don't know, thousands of people lining the exit, holding their hands out, shake your hands.
How'd that make you feel?
Oh, that tall. That tall.
At the World War II Memorial, where they have that big wall of gold stars, and you know what it represents.
Yeah.
406,000. And you had a couple chances where that could have been you.
Yeah, that's right.
What did you think about when you were looking at that next to a daughter who wouldn't be here if you didn't survive?
That's right. Well, you know, again, I think to myself, if it hadn't been for training and men upset, I wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. I think about that.
Again, that was Mel Pliner. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And we're not done yet. When this special Operation Varsity 75th Anniversary Edition returns, we'll hear from one of the thousands of American paratroopers who descended along the Rhine River on March 24, 1945. It was his very first taste of combat, and we'll hear about it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, "One of these days I'm going to do something with those"? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking 75 years since a World War II effort that is often overlooked but certainly never forgotten by anyone who took part in the largest airborne operation ever carried out on a single day in a single spot on the map. Operation Varsity dropped nearly 17,000 American, British, and Canadian troops into combat against German forces near Wesel, Germany on March 24, 1945. For one of those American paratroopers with the golden Talons of the 17th Airborne Division. He never would have known his real name if it wasn't for World War II. The oldest boy among seven children in his family in Uvalde, Texas, Julian Mazuka would spend most of his life as a sheep shearer, keeping his skills sharp by cutting the hair of his fellow soldiers during World War II. We'll get to his memories of that Operation Varsity jump, but let's start with his recollection of December 7th, 1941, and the journey that news of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor started for him.
I remember that very well. I was in Arizona working in the ranch or someplace, and I remember well.
What did it mean to you as a young man? You were just 20 years old at the time.
I don't know what to say. Well, I mean, that really is not very good.
Did it occur to you at all that what was starting to happen might involve you at some point, that you might have to do something?
Yeah, I know that. And that's when I registered for the service, and I had a different name. I don't know. My name was Julian Mazuka. They used to call me Pedro. And when I went to register for the service, they had to take my birth certificate. And there was Julian. And I asked my mother, how come they call me Pedro and my real name is Julian? I said, your grandma changed your name because you look like your grandfather.
So they've been lying to you all those years?
For a long, long time. And from then on, I know that I had to use my right name, Julian, and that's what I used my right name.
So all your buddies in the war certainly called you by that name. But you didn't go right away. How many deferments did you get and why?
Three. Yeah. Three deferments because I was chip churning and I got a chance to 6 months in each deferment. And after three deferments is no more, they called me to go on for my physical. And the next day, I mean the same day, they called me and I wasn't there at 11 o'clock giving the papers put me in the train to San Pedro, to Los Angeles, and they picked me up in Los Angeles, take me to San Pedro, and they put uniform on me.
Going to San Pedro is almost enough to make you want to change your name back to Pedro.
Yeah, almost. Yeah.
But what do you think your expectations were about going in the Army? Because by this time, February of 1944, there's a lot that's been happening. You probably heard about some of this war overseas.
Well, I was not afraid to. I was willing to go and do my service. I had a lot of offers to go to Mexico and forget about going to service. I said, no, I'll stay here. If the rest of the guys go, I go. And that's where I went. And you know, to be a paratrooper, that's a big commandment. You have to raise your right hand and you said, they asked if you're willing to jump any place, any time to defend your country. And I said, yes, I do.
Had you ever been in an airplane before?
No, never been in an airplane. And that's the guy, we was in a basic training in Little Rock, Arkansas. A couple of weeks before we finished the training, they takes to the theater and show how they want to volunteer for paratroopers. And the guy that was my friend who was staying in the same barracks, his name is Tony Maris. He said, let's go and be signed for paratroopers. I said, no, I don't say, yeah, we got the guns too.
That must have been a good movie.
So we signed up, and about a week later, they called us for another physical, and he didn't pass the physical, and I do.
So he pulled a fast one on you. He's the one who got you to volunteer, and he didn't have to do it, huh? So you grew up in Texas. You joined the service out of Arizona, came to California for training, all the way across to Georgia. You saw a lot of the country, but had you ever been on a ship before they shipped you out?
No, I've never been.
So what was that like? What do you remember about heading overseas?
Well, it was very nice. We went back aboard called La Quitinia, the largest, biggest in England, got 13,000 troops. And we land in Laca Beach, Scotland. And then from there, we were train all the way to London. And to London, we crossed the channel again.
Did you get seasick at all on that journey?
I never got seasick.
How was the food?
Very good. We eat twice a day, but we were all right.
You had a birthday cruise, huh? You had your birthday on the ship?
Yeah. It was in January 28th.
What did they do for you? Did anybody know it was your birthday?
Nobody knew. Just myself.
Do you remember what you were thinking going overseas? Because here your family didn't want you to go. They wanted you to go to Mexico and avoid all this. And here you are heading overseas. What do you think you were thinking at the time?
I was young. I didn't think something about it. Just, if something happened, it's going to happen. If it don't, that's it. That's the way that feels.
Did you get letters from home?
Oh, yeah. My folks are used to write it to them.
And you moved pretty quickly from Scotland into England, then across to France. And what did you find when you got there, where all that intense fighting had been months earlier?
Well, everything was destroyed when we went in France, especially when they crossed the channel. That town was completely demolished.
What was it like to see that? Because I imagine you'd never been anywhere where that was what was in front of you.
Kind of surprised me to see something like that. I mean, I didn't figure something like that. But
were you anticipating the first time that you would actually jump when it mattered, when this was an actual mission against the enemy? What do you remember about the build-up to that?
I know we were going to jump, and we had to do the best they know. You know, but a week before jump, we studied everything. They briefed on everything. What canals and power lines and all of that, everything. And we know what we're supposed to do. As soon as we hit the ground, we know exactly what we're supposed to do. And like we jumped 10 minutes behind the 2nd Battalion. By the time we hit the ground, we're bullets going in all directions. Airplanes burning, houses burning, and that's a big mess. When we jumped, we tried to go to Berlin. That's where you're supposed to go. And this is where we drove. I mean, as soon as we hit the ground, we two divisions jumping in the same place, England and Americans. The England went towards the Rhine, America, we went towards Berlin. And we put mountains on days on the front line before the Second Army take over.
Yeah, so you had over a month of frontline combat after parachuting in, but you guys took off from France. This was an absolutely massive effort. While the ground troops are hoping to cross the Rhine, you get dropped on the other side of the Rhine, behind enemy lines. And you landed near Wesel, Germany, determined to fight your way to Berlin. I know how to spell it, W-E-S-E-L, but where exactly is Wesel?
It's 25 miles the other side of the Rhine. And from then on, we go all the way to Berlin. And that highway, I mean, they call it Autobahn. Yeah. That's a big freeway going to Berlin. Some of the guys were on the left, some on the right. And we go straight up. Every day we march. We take a little town every day, one or two towns, and sometimes we burn places because we get a fire and happened. We happen to go that way, they burn the whole town. Quite a few towns we destroy.
I know that most of your experience was on the ground, but I want to get this picture. I'm sure a lot of people are fascinated by how this all started. And I imagine it struck you, the magnitude of this, when you guys were taken off. How many different airplanes full of paratroopers were going? I mean, there must have been a lot of birds in the sky, so to speak.
There was.
Was it kind of awe-inspiring to see so many planes going up at the same time?
Surprised me to see something like that. And surprised me when the Second Army take over. Well, all day, they don't have to fight. They give us a rest. They take over, and the following day, Germany surrendered. So I don't think they had to fight a bullet. They're going straight on.
You guys did all the work for them, I guess. Tell me also, what was it like jumping out of that C-47 on this mission? So you guys get to where you're supposed to drop, and then it's time to actually do this, what you've practiced so many times and trained for. Do you remember that moment when you exited the airplane and how that all unfolded?
Oh, yeah. I remember very well, but that's what we're supposed to do. That's why we do it.
Were you nervous at all jumping out? Were you confident you'd get it right, that your chute would open, that you'd land in the right place? I mean, what were you thinking?
Well, I was thinking, I hope nobody hit me. That's what I was saying. I hope no bullet hit me. And luckily, nothing happened. So they hit the ground, and we're ready to go. And we started to go where you're supposed to go.
And what all were you armed with?
M1.
You had an M1 rifle. Did you have any grenades? What else were you carrying?
We got some grenades and M1 ammunition, and we had fruit for 3 or 4 days, K-rations, they call it K-ration. And that's all the blanket and the things in the back.
How soon did you encounter the enemy? How long did it take before you saw the enemy and they were shooting at you?
The sooner we hit the ground, we can see bullets coming in all directions, and the house is burning, and we're ready to go. You see somebody, we took it's the enemy, we let it go, we let it have it. Ever since they moved, we shoot him.
Were you scared?
No.
Why not?
I don't know. I never get scared. I mean, I just hope it's nothing. Nobody hit me, and that's it. Yeah, I was very lucky, and nothing happened. Not even one scratch.
You said you weren't scared, and I guess maybe if you're going to be successful as a paratrooper, maybe you need to put that out of your mind. But where do you think that came from? What convinced you that you were going to be okay and you were going to make it through all this?
That's pretty hard to say. I don't know. I was young. I don't think nothing bad going to happen to me, but I was willing to take whatever they come. I don't think about that. When your time comes, and that's it. I'm the hard believer. When the time comes, and that's it, no matter what.
How did it affect you the first time you saw one of your fellow paratroopers get killed in combat?
Well, I see quite a few. Yeah, especially my company commander. He's right close to me. Not very far from somebody shoot him right in the head. Down he went. 3 days after we jumped, we got some tanks come and help us. And we were supposed to be behind the tanks. And he got a little bit to the right, and they got hit. And we lost quite a few.
Did that trouble you? Did that make you wonder if you were going to be next? Was it just painful?
They don't see. That's when the tanks come, and that's it. I was maybe that was helping me. I was afraid of nothing.
So would you say you kind of got numb to it?
Well, yeah, and I was a little bit crazy. You know, when they crossed the canal after 3 days, there was quite a few. There was a machine gun to the left, a machine gun to the right, and I got on top of the left and looked around, and the sergeant said, "Julian, get out of there, you're gonna get hit." I said, "They don't like Mexicans."
And it worked, I guess. You must have been right.
I've been right. By golly, Tony Garcia, he's the one that shoot those two machines, one on the left and one on the right. He sneaked in, and boy, he hit it. He got a silver medal for that.
Silver star for taking out those machine guns. Is that one of those things, sticking your head up like that? Is that one of those things you look back on now and say, what was I thinking?
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking. I said, when the time comes, the time's coming. That's it. Don't worry. I don't worry about things.
Well, I'm glad your time didn't come right there, because you got a couple daughters and 5 grandkids and 5 great-grandkids who wouldn't be here if it did. When you think back about all that, is there one moment that you think was your closest call, the closest you came to when your time comes, your time comes?
Well, when we crossed the canal, I was trying to get in a tree, and I guess they see me, and they was shooting, and I could see the bullets hit the tree. And it was pretty close.
But nothing ever hit you? You never wounded at all?
Not even when they jumped and we got no scratch or nothing. Some of the guys got scratches and all of that, and broken legs and some of that, but I didn't have no problems at all.
So this is the spring of 1945, and the war in Europe ended in May of 1945. Did you guys have a sense that you were getting close to finishing this up, that you were about to defeat Germany?
But couple of weeks after we jumped, they tried to give up. Sometimes we get as much as 500, 600, they want to surrender. They come and say, that's it, they don't want no more fight.
So you guys would take them prisoner and get them somewhere?
The sergeant said, 3 volunteers, you and you go get them. So we're going to bring it in. One America in the front, and one in the left, and one in the right, and one behind.
You just march them around like that. There was a situation where you personally captured 3 Germans?
Yeah, well, I wasn't even in the front line. Some of the guys were about a mile ahead of us in the front line. And we go back to the haystack. And when I went back to the haystack, I smelled something like a human beings. And I said, I smelled something here. And the guy said, yeah, somebody shot at you guys. I know, I smelled something else. So when I kicked the hay, here's 3 Germans inside of that haystack. As soon as I hit the hay, they started moving the legs, and they here come.
So were you checking every haystack you saw after that, or what?
Not very many haystacks, and I happened to go in that one. And this was.
Well, and let me ask you about that. I don't know how many of you guys there were, but was that a situation where they were just hiding and hoping nobody found them, or was that a situation where they had weapons and could have killed you if you didn't see them?
They didn't have no weapons. They tried to survive because we check everything and there's no weapons inside of us. I guess they throw the weapons or hide them someplace. So I don't know, but they're trying to.
Well, you know, another interesting question, I guess, to ask, and I've had different takes on this one, too, is how did you feel about the Germans, the guys that you were fighting, the guys that almost killed you a couple times? How did you feel about the enemy?
just like us, you know, when something, when we on the front line, if something happened, we use the same guys to pull the ones that got wounded. The same Germany, they helped to help, and we did the same to them. They got hit, they're in bad shape, we get them out and help them out.
You saw some of your medics help out wounded Germans.
Yeah, we do quite a few then. We get them out and they're in bad shape, they want to survive.
When did you find out that Germany surrendered, and what was that moment like?
I feel there was something big. We don't have to fight no more.
Did you guys celebrate a little bit?
The Second Army take over, we get quite a bit of relief. We don't have to be in the front line. The Second Army take over. And the following day, they surrendered, so they don't have to do very much.
Yeah. So you guys had already gone back for R&R or what?
Well, after we do that, they changed to another camp. There was a little town they call Oberhaus in Stuttgart. And they had a German camps, in it, I mean, a Russian camp. They all those prisoners, they got ahead of them in those camps. Mm-hmm. And they used to get up in the nighttime and do quite a bit of damage. So we put a quite a few from 6 to 6. They're supposed to be out after 6 o'clock. They had to be in the camp. And they were always doing, watching those things.
Did you hear at any point during this time about the concentration camps and about what the Germans had done to their political prisoners and the Jewish people?
I was in the camp. I see some they are in bad shape. Some already died, and some was ready to be dying in pretty bad shape. I mean, not even one, quite a few.
When you saw that and realized what those people had been through, how did that affect you?
Well, it's pretty hard to see those poor guys dying in pretty bad shape. They didn't have nothing. We try to help as much as we can, but I know they need help real bad.
I've had a lot of guys tell me that America was different then, and that there was a unity in this country, that everybody believed in what you guys were doing, and you were all in it together. Did you feel something like that?
Well, I was very proud of what we do. I was feeling very proud of myself, and I'm very proud of what I've been doing.
And it sounds like they made you feel like they were pretty proud of you, too.
I think so.
When you think back on all of that now, everything that you endured, everything that you went through, being a paratrooper and a World War II veteran, what are you most proud of?
Well, I guess what I did, I was very proud of what I did. And it's something that nobody can take it away from you. So it's just something you remember the rest of your life. It's those guys that got killed and they didn't come home. And we think it was lucky, one like me. Nothing happens.
Those who survive tell the stories that help the rest of us understand the magnitude of the sacrifice for those who did not. That's all the time we have on this edition of Hometown Heroes. If you're interested in more on Operation Varsity, make sure to track down that 75th anniversary commemoration online on Tuesday, March 24th. As we all step gingerly into this uncharted territory the coronavirus pandemic presents, let's remember that we really are all in this together. I'm Paul Leffler saying thanks so much for listening and reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.